Okay, this time we're going to be looking at children that struggle again, but we're going to be looking at remediations and techniques to be used for those children. And there's handouts going around, and we'll be kind of somewhat talking off of these handouts. And again, I want this to be interactive. I want you to save your questions, be ready, you know. Let's talk about things that will make this personal to you and the challenges you have in your school setting. We often, when we face these children in our situation in the classroom, we are wondering, what have we gotten ourselves into, or what am I going to do with these situations? And there are some questions here as the handouts are going around. The first question is, what do I do with this child who struggles? A lot of times teachers just, where do I go? And I've heard these questions from teachers. Is there something I'm not doing? Is there something I should be doing? When we're a little bit at a loss as to what's going on, we don't know the nature of what we're dealing with. We don't really know what to do, and we're a little bit fearful ourselves of making mistakes and making matters worse. So I encourage the first step to answer these questions and wondering about, where am I headed here? The first step in these questions, getting these answers, is to stop and let's do some evaluation. Let's see if we can discover the nature of what's going on. It's kind of like if you had someone that maybe they have a skin issue. You know, there's some redness and some it's itchy and it just goes on. We put creams on it and we smear things on it and we dab things on it, and finally we realize it's the laundry detergent. Okay, what we've done is we've gone to the actual issue. The lotions weren't doing a bit of good. Those approaches, putting band-aids on things, does get them out of sight. And sometimes if we get things out of sight, they're out of mind and we think they're gone, but no, they're not. They're going to come back out. These types of struggles that are part of the way a child or a person is made up, they will show themselves again. Let's do some evaluating. What is some evaluating that we can do? Right up front are two physical evaluations that I always encourage when people tell me they've got a child that is struggling. Number one, let's check their eyes. See, are they seeing well? Because if we aren't taking in and neurologically processing what's before us, it's hard for us to deal with it and to process it and to store it and to retrieve it and use it. And you know, a person that has never seen well doesn't realize there's any other way to see. I've seen this with children, different times, that the teacher notices the squint and cocking of the head and turning, you know, trying to do different things that my brain says, that's a little better. The lens, the view is a little bit better. And they might not be seeing quite well, so we move them up to the front of the room. Things seem to improve a little bit. The whole working process, the mechanism seems to be turning better. This is especially in young children. And to get their eyes checked, and the eye doctor says, this child really needs glasses. They're not seeing very well at all. And the world just opens up for those children. Another thing is their ears. If a child does not hear well, it's just like the eyes. They cannot take the message, the material, into their neurological processing machinery. Had a little girl that was in the second grade one year. Actually, she was my niece. Struggled in the first grade. Didn't do very well. She was a real struggler. Came into the second grade, she was struggling good, pretty good too. It was a mystery to the teacher. It seemed like that if you would try to graph the efforts, it would look like this. Now that's a mystery when a child processes like that. Now if they process like this, okay, that's struggling, consistency. If they process up here, we're all happy with that. But when they go like this, we're trying to figure out what's happening up here and why are we down here the next time. The issue was her ears. The teacher happened to be, the way it all came about that she discovered it, she was talking to the class, just like I'm talking to you, and she walked behind my niece. She had kind of lost, wasn't paying attention, and that was another thing the teacher would complain about a little bit, is she doesn't pay attention very well. See, so she was getting marked with a negative mark right there. Well, the teacher walked past her, and as she walked behind her, she mentioned something to her. Well, no response. Walked a little further, and she was either handing out something or doing something that she was kind of preoccupied. No response. The other students are like looking at her, the little girl, like, you know, she's talking to you. You need to pay. I mean, what's, nobody's knowing what's going on. Well, she's just busily looking at something on her desk. The teacher turned around, looked back there a couple of seats, and this little girl has, she's not anywhere near. So she walks back in front of her and said, "Amelia." Oh, her head popped up. And then she talked to her, and she was okay with that. Amelia was just, could barely hear, and no one knew it. Amelia lived this way. She didn't realize there's a world out there with a lot of sound in it. This is the way her eardrums were. She had become excellent at reading lips. She was a second grader, and if she was looking at you, and the teacher was talking to the students, she was getting it. That's the reason for the peak. But if she was explaining things with her back turned, Amelia's trying to figure out what's going on. She had to piece together with little bits of sound and what's being written on the board. She had to try to construct what's being taught. And that's where she was headed down. When she got hearing aids, Amelia picked up and leveled off, not at the top, but quite a bit further than what she had before, because she couldn't hear what was going on in the class. So those are two things that I always encourage parents and teachers to talk with the parents about, is let's see how well they're taking in the information, and then we'll look at processing. There's some questions to ask yourself as a teacher. If you have a student that is struggling, to help you kind of start down the road to evaluate, you can ask yourself some questions. Is this a phonetic struggle? And by that we mean, does it have to do with the way sounds and letters and words work together? Does it have to do with the phonics of reading? That's what the phonetics is all about. Is this a phonetic problem? Does this child struggle to read? Do they read fairly well, but their spelling is off? Or they struggle to put words together? And there's a reason for that. Spelling is the ultimate process of putting words together. We have to have the sounds and the letters that represent the sounds, and then the sound. Those letters go together to build words by the rules of phonics. We build words with those. And how do we know how to put those together? With our phonetic tools that we learned in our phonics program. That knowledge is what we call your phonetic tools. They're stored in your workshop, where everything you read coming in, or where you want to spell and write going back out, passes through that workshop. And your phonetic tools are what you use to put those things together, or either to take them apart. So, the less tools you have, the harder the job. It's just like any kind of workshop. The better it's equipped and outfitted with tools, the better the job can be. The fewer the tools, the harder the job is going to be to tackle. So if this is a phonetic problem, and sometimes reading, they'll say, oh, they read fairly well, but they struggle. We always ask the second question, what's their spelling like? And we're not talking about spelling tests or spelling grades. Those are things they're drilled. We're talking about their everyday use of writing out words. What does that look like? And then a second question you might ask yourself, now this is, we're trying to do a little evaluating here. The second question you might ask yourself, is it genetically present in the family? One easy way to this is if they're siblings that have been through school before or in school now, is it genetically present in any of the other siblings? A struggle of this nature. Okay? And then another question is it present in mom or dad? Did they struggle? Do they maybe still struggle with spelling or don't care to read and things of that nature? Phonetic struggles. If you get a yes on those points, that it is genetically present, then you are more than likely looking dyslexia square in the face. Because dyslexia is always genetically passed on. That's the way it goes from child to child, generation to generation. It's through genetics. It's going to always be present in one of the family, in one of the parents. And what's easiest for us to pick up on is if there are other siblings involved. And when we see that that's what we're dealing with, we have an evaluation here. We have something that we can actually look at and have a handle on. What am I going to do with this? See, longer ago, dyslexia was not understood. For a long time, it's just been a catch bag of struggles. If a child struggled, oh, he's probably just dyslexic. They didn't even know what dyslexia was. But we do know a lot more about it because of technology and the studies. And actually, my wife and I, when we took our graduate level course on dyslexia and brain processing, we got to look at some testing results. One of those was an fMRI. An fMRI is an MRI that is like a video. It's not a snapshot like an X-ray or a normal MRI. It's a continuous watching of process. An MRI is something that we can see soft tissue with. So we can watch the brain in action. And on the things that we were exposed to, the brain was a bright green and the blood was a brilliant red. So it was easy and quite graphic to understand what was going on. It was interesting. When a non-dyslexic person picks up something and began to read it, our body rushes oxygen-rich blood, which is easy to identify because of the color of it, to the part of the brain that is being used. Our body does that. God has created us that whatever part of our body we're putting into action, muscles in a certain place to pull, we're going to get a shot of oxygen-rich blood to that area. Same way with the brain. The brain has many different functions. And the area that's being used gets a shot of oxygen-rich blood. So when that person picks up something and begins to read it, we see that blood rush come to the, first of all, to the optical part and the neurological pathways that are going to carry this information into the eyes and into the brain for processing. And then it will trickle back on the left-hand side here. It will flow back. And right here on the side, in the lobal area here, we'll just call this, actually in the temporal area, we'll call it the workshop. That's where our processing goes on. And that's where our tools are that we have learned in phonics. And as we carry these letters and words in, we decode them. We take them apart. I'm sure you don't realize that's what happens when you read. But when you read a word, that word comes into your brain, that set of letters, and your brain decodes it. It takes it apart. It sees all of the sounds in there. And you unravel that word. You see all of the sounds. It slams it back together, and you see it as a word now because your phonetic tools tell you how these sounds work together, and you've built a word. You recognize it. You've processed it. And now it goes back here in this lobal area back here, and we'll call it the learning center. And it's stored away as knowledge, and it can be retrieved. But for a person that has a different brain design, and we're talking about the dyslexic here, a different brain design that physically processes differently and decodes differently. When that material comes in, when they begin to read, the same things start out. The blood comes up here. The optics have gone to work. The information travels in, and it travels into their temporal area here, and the blood just balls up. And it only trickles back here. That's because of what's going on in here. We're trying to process with just a few tools these things that are coming into me. And it'll even light up some areas on the right-hand side of the brain that it's trying to carry this optical information back here to the learning center where it knows it's supposed to go, without processing it. Now, the brain is beyond man's understanding and complexity. But when technology was able to watch this in action, we finally could see dyslexia. We could see the struggle of someone that is trying to simply read and decode words and what they're dealing with. In decoding, when we decode words, I'm sure all of you as teachers have heard children that read very stiff and stumbly, and adults as well. Instead of reading, you know, Jack saw the cat run across the road and up the tree. Then you've got the child that struggles. Jack saw the ran, cat ran. All of that is an indication of how he's processing. He's processing letter, letter, letter. He's pulled it apart. But see, he doesn't have the ability, because of the equipment he has, he does not have the ability to decode smoothly. The smoother a person decodes, and it doesn't take long in their learning to read, that this becomes smoother and smoother. And this is what we call reading fluency. That decoding of words. And it just flows. Most of these children and a lot of these people never can flow. They read stumbly, and they have to read the word. Because if they don't, they resort to when they get under pressure or they're trying to perform. They read these words, word, word, word. And then to alleviate the pressure, anybody does anything they can to make life easier or to get the job done. And that's what starts happening when they start working with something like this and they're under pressure. They start to double task. You know, the book says plainly, the cat ran across the road and up the tree. But when they're stumbling along, it turns into the kitty ran across the lane. And the teacher's wondering, where's he getting lane from? Where did he get the kitty from? It says plainly, but see, he's decoding these things, but he's also thinking about the whole scenario. And he's, especially if there's pictures there, he's trying to make these words say what he thinks they're trying to say. And he's beginning to help them out. There's a lot of work put into that, whether you realize it or not, that you can't just smoothly decode and read the words that are there. So, this thing, if this is the struggle, and this reading and understanding and comprehension of what you're reading is all about schoolwork. It's what we apply to everything we do. It's going to affect every part of it. Some other telltale things that you can recognize in evaluating is to ask, is to become aware. That's one thing, is just become aware of what the particulars are of the struggle. Not just that it's a struggle. Let's wonder a little bit about what's going on. Do they struggle in telling time with a clock that has hands on it? You know, there's several things that are involved in telling time. It's said that the dyslexic praises the person that invented the digital clock. Because you've got two hands, and you've got 12 numbers, and you've got 60 increments up there on that clock, and you've got to figure out how they work together to be 1:35. It's a process. It's a multi-step process. I had a daughter that she was in the third grade and she couldn't tell time on a clock. She's dyslexic. But we didn't know what we were going to do with her. I didn't understand dyslexia at that time. So we finally bought her a watch. And all little girls are tickled with the watch. And we figured if she has this thing to actually wear on herself and look at all the time, like little girls do that get new watches, something's going to click. But you know, it still took her a little while. Because now she had her own little watch, and she had an extra motivation that she wanted to understand this thing. And we were asking her, quite frequently, what time is it? Oh, she'd readily look at her little watch. And then you could see her brain, the wheels went to turning. And after a while, long after it would normally be for children to tell time, she could tell you what time it was. Things that have multiple steps in it that you have to keep one step plainly in your mind, think through the next step and apply it to the first one, hanging now onto two steps and going for another one. Multi-step processing is something that teachers notice, that especially when it sometimes comes to math, that they struggle with math, but it's not the actual facts. It is going through the math problem. Or either if you give them multiple in adults, it's quite evident when you give them directions. Go down here and turn right. Go three blocks and turn right again. And so on. They were lost at the first turn. They just can't keep it straight. And I'm a dyslexic. So when I give directions, I think of myself and I think of the way I process. I'm going to put other things into it. You're going to go down here to the Exxon station and turn right. We'll cross the railroad track and turn left. See, I'm giving you extra things to attach to that picture. You need a picture in your mind. And that needs to be a challenge to us as teachers. When you're working with someone that thinks like this and processes this way, it doesn't hurt the others to give them all the extras as well. But for us as teachers to think that I'm going to actually, in my words and in my explanations, I need to paint them a mental picture of what we're talking about. I need to get pretty graphic and pretty interesting. And use your board. You know, again, get up, give them things to attach words to help them paint that picture, to draw that picture in their mind so that they can see those mind pictures. Most often, we hear students that get to the third grade, and that's where teachers will say, you know, the thing of he was doing good in the first grade, in the second grade he did fair. There's always been somewhat of a little struggle here, but in the third grade, we don't know what we're going to do with him. It seems as though he can't read anymore. No, what's really happening here is reading and academics is changing quite rapidly. To the third grade level, we have a lot more multi-syllable words, larger amounts of reading and written material, and we have a lot less pictures. We expect them to process the reading instead of having to have the graphics to go with it. See, and that's where these people, they depend on these things. We have to make up the picture ourselves. If it's in the book already, and then there's some reading under here, that is a tremendous help. But suppose it's not. They've got to come up with this. They've got to come up with their own mind pictures as to what this writing is all about. But if we help them with that, if we'll give them, besides just the written material that's in the book, but maybe pictures we have of our own, or something we jot down on the board, something that leads them to painting the pictures in their mind to go along with the words, we can do them a big help by doing that. Using attachments. And what I mean by attachments is something that you can attach knowledge to that is known. And take this new material that you're trying to impart to them for knowledge and attach it to something that is clearly understood. I talked in the last session about the rickshaw. I can still remember the first time I taught social studies. I was only a substitute at the time. I had a feeling God was trying to get me in the school, but I did substitute, and that's what did it, was that substituting. But I remember I was teaching a social studies class. It was in probably the fourth grade, and we were over in the Orient somewhere, and they were talking about this rickshaw and these people that were hailed down the rickshaw and jumped in. I realized these students, in my thinking, in pictures in my mind, I saw this Oriental person, you know, trotting down the street, pulling his rickshaw, and hey, you know, somebody flags him down, you know, and they jump in, pay their fare, and tell him where they want him to go. And these children didn't have a clue what a rickshaw was. They didn't know if it has a 350 in it, or four wheels, or eight wheels. Is it four-wheel drive? What is this thing? And I explained a little bit what it was like, and after I ran back and forth and crossed in front of the room a couple of times, supposedly carrying a rickshaw, they had a good idea of what we're talking about. This thing just took on a whole different scene. Don't be afraid to teach like that, to help them understand, to grasp a mental picture of what we're talking about. And also, when we're be pretty quick to go somewhere with a new concept or idea that is common knowledge to them, something they're familiar with, and attach it to it so that they can readily grasp where we are. Keep them together. Watch for the lights to come on. Watch for that. Find ways to include the fine motor nerve system and other kinesthetic methods to reinforce. And the reason for that is that everything extra that we do in helping these techniques will help the child get a better grip on the knowledge. Attach it to something. We've got a first grade, well, a preschool tutor right now that's working with some struggling students, and she's teaching them their letters. She's having them write in sand because they can feel that. And it's they can see it. They're doing it. Have children do things that involve the kinesthetic movements of their body, their fingers, their motor nerve system. That is proven to help them understand and grasp things faster. My wife and I were in Papua New Guinea a couple of years ago with the CLE crew there. We were talking to teachers from all over the island who'd come together in a pretty big convention. Had about 100 teachers there. And some of those teachers don't even have schools. Well, they do, but there's consists of four poles and a bamboo hut with leaves on top of it. And no desk to work in. They have logs that are cut off. And for a chalkboard, they go on that pretty white sand they have down there, and they'll flatten and smooth off a place. And each child gets a space of sand to work in. And it is absolutely amazing how fast they teach those children to read and write. They take, and English is not their first language, but they take them there so quickly because of those brilliant little minds and all of that kinesthetic teaching. It's done in sand. Get outside the box. But in evaluating, there's things we need to do to figure out what's going on here and things we can do then to remediate. There are a couple things that I suggest to teachers to use for math. And that also goes back to this thing of using your hands, your fingers, your eyes. You can get these little whiteboards. We think often teachers will say they just don't have this in little ones, the concept of math. They don't seem to, the thing of adding and carrying and math has to be understood well from the foundation up. To try to build on math and climb on up through first and second grade and not have the foundation there, you're going to constantly crumble and fall and flounder, and it's going to be frustrating for everybody. But one thing that can really help them is to get a good grip on this is let them build these problems. Actually build them with their hands. A whiteboard that you can stick magnets on, you can get them at Walmart, and also their dry eraser boards. Let them go to that dry eraser board and write the problem. 3 + 5 = and then go under that problem and build it. You can get little craft magnets at the craft stores. And 3 magnets go under the 3. 5 magnets go under the 5. And then they count up all their magnets. You can do this with subtraction. You can work all of math in this manner. And then count up your magnets equals, and then put 8 magnets out there. You have built this problem. They see it in their mind. They went from beginning to end. They see the whole problem. They thoroughly understand how it works. And it doesn't take long, usually, for them to grasp. And again, it goes back to seeing in their mind the problem. See, math is only, it's a process. It has three parts. It has the symbol, that's what we call the letter. It has the name of the symbol. And it has the value of the symbol. And children have to clearly understand all three parts to be able to handle math effectively. You might think, oh, that one part, if they've got two, but I'm going to tell you, it doesn't work like that. I had a granddaughter that, if you'd ask her how old she is, and she was getting ready to go into first grade, how old are you? How much is that? 9? But if you would ask her to say it, I'm six. There was an element missing here. It was mystifying everybody. And finally, I got involved in it, and I realized she doesn't know the name of the letters. She doesn't know the names of them. She knows what... She can go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, she could count up to quite high if she counted in sequence. But if you would flash her something like this, what is that? Unless you gave her time to name them off, she was lost. She did not know the name. She knew the value and everything. And that's what was just totally throwing everybody out. She could work a math problem, but she couldn't say how old she is. It was simply because she was missing one part. We as teachers, it's very important to help make sure children know. Do some evaluation. Find out what's going on when they struggle. Because with math, there is an issue that's just like dyslexia is to letters. It's called dyscalculia. And that is involving math. Dyscalculia is a person that does not have the ability to understand how numbers work. They just don't make any sense to these people. They don't have the ability to calculate. And a 17 is just as good as a 38. They don't care. And it frustrates teachers very much to deal with a person like this. Makes them want to just bang their head on the wall because, can't you see? There's a 1 and a 7. Sorry, it doesn't work. My brain doesn't go there. And I've talked to adults after giving talks like this that would come to me later and say, you just described me. Numbers have never made a bit of sense to me. I can't understand how they work. And these were adults. They weren't teachers, thankfully. So, in evaluating, try to get a grip on what's actually going on here. Another one is a math program called MathUC. That may be one that you've heard of. That is one that uses actually manipulatives to build problems. It is a math curriculum. And I've never taught it, but I've talked to many people that have, and they said it really worked for them. It is very important to teach the how and the why when we're teaching. Not just that this is what it is, but to be sure to go into the how it works and why we do it. Why they do things. How they do things. in all of the subjects. It's much easier to go to the how and the why in science. That is a subject where that is very important. And that is a subject that a lot of children struggle in other subjects enjoy, because they can relate to that. But the how and the why is where we go further than just this is what it is, in remediating and teaching techniques. The how and the why helps me understand in a deeper aspect, and see, for dyslexic children or people, that's the way we think. That's the reason we take things apart. That's the reason we invent things to, or try to figure out how things work and why they do what they do, because that's the way we think. We can't help it. It's the processing our brain does. And that's the reason these people are our inventors and our architects. And I could tell you stories about dyslexia today, modern neurological brain surgeons that couldn't, their story of their getting into medical school was that they could hardly pass their entrance exam. It didn't look very good. But once they moved that type of things out of their way, they delved into the field of neurological study and have gone places and today perform surgeries that are just totally unheard of. And we wonder, how in the world did they ever think of doing that? It was there. It was the way they think. How can I tell? There's one more way when you're working with children that are struggling that I haven't mentioned, because it's not something that you could do in the classroom. And that is what we do. We screen children phonetically. We put them through if it's a question, if it's a mystery to us, what's going on with this child, then we can actually screen them, and the screen will tell the truth. It will tell how they phonetically process. It will expose it. And the screening is something that takes place. We put them through a series of little tests of working with sounds and removing parts of words to tell us what's left over, putting words together and seeing and processing and decoding the new word. We want to see how they process words in phonetics. And when we're through, we'll work up a summary page that will tell us, it'll kind of draw a portrait of their ability to phonetically process. And it will tell us what we're working with here. Now, if you don't have your tools to process with, you are going to come out on a screen like that looking like, would you think, a dyslexic? No. It's very surprising. I'll tell you right quick what happened with us. We were called into a school where there was two first graders, and the first graders went through first grade, went into second grade, and second grade teacher says something's wrong here. I mean, bad wrong. They called us in. We looked at the children's work, and the work just screamed of dyslexia. Oh, the work, dysgraphia, it looked bad. Okay, let's talk to the parents. Do they want a screening? We talked to the parents. We asked them, genetically, do either one of you struggle or have struggled? Nope. Oh, really? Do you have older children? Mm-hmm. When they went through school, did any of them struggle in these ways? Nope. This son is the only one we've ever seen like this. Well, my wife and I, we looked at each other and immediately we said, we're going to have to screen this little fellow. Because, see, if all the evidence is there, a screening is only going to show us what we've already discovered. But there wasn't anything in place here. We screened the little fella. And you know what the screen showed? That he phonetically processes very well. It doesn't depend on his knowledge. It's going to look at how he processes. That's what the screen will do. And that screen showed that he understood and processed phonetically very well. Do you realize what was going on in school then? He's working without his tools. He was never given tools to use. All of this pointed back to the first grade teacher. I don't know if there are any in here. First grade is so important. In talking with the first grade teacher, she readily said she doesn't even understand how phonics works. That in her curriculum she had wall bullet cards, you know, but she never knew what they were for, so she didn't put them up. These children went through the first grade and came out without any phonetic tools. And they were operating just like a dyslexic child would. But they had all of the phonetic processing they needed. It was someone else's problem. So they didn't need the Barton program. They didn't need a remediation program. They just needed a phonics program and to get it good and go for it. So it's so important that we help them lay that foundation. But you've been given a sheet there that talks about the Barton program. That is a program that we point people to. It is a phonics program, is what it is. It is a reading and spelling phonics program. We point people towards that program for their remediation because it works. It is a good program. It has some real advantages for small schools in purchasing and the way it's used and can be copied and used over and over. There's a lot of advantages there. But one of the main things is it works. In its methods and teaching. It teaches phonics from an angle of how and why you do what you do. The way a dyslexic thinks, the way a child thinks that needs his extra handles. And it gives them the tools to decode with that they need. I have watched my wife. We actually have tutored the program. She tutored it. We had to get it started in our area down there, and then we handed it off to tutors. But watching the Barton program myself, just when we happen to be in schools where it's going on, I like to go in and sit in and watch the tutor. It makes such absolute sense. I've told her different times, why couldn't someone have taught me phonics that way? It makes complete sense. But I actually had phonics twice. I went through the first grade and it didn't do any good, so they tutored me with the same program. And again, through a special tutor, and it didn't do any. They soaked this rock in the same liquid twice, and it didn't soak up any more the second time it did the first. So, closing this thing down, I'd like to give you a good book to read on understanding dyslexia in children that struggle with that, and actually a really inside picture. It's called Overcoming Dyslexia by Sally Shaywitz. Overcoming Dyslexia. And Shaywitz is spelled Shaywitz. It's a very good read. It's easy to understand. And it'll give you real insight into the way these children process. And I'll close with a little saying here that when I think of teaching and really getting it to stick is one that Benjamin Franklin left us. Says, tell me, and I forget. Teach me, I'll remember, but involve me, and I'll learn. That's the secret that I found in learning myself. So God bless you as you go back to your places of responsibility and your classrooms that are waiting on you to be teachers especially if you have struggling students to work with. You're dismissed.